Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Danielle, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop update on mesothelioma. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other organizations, many other cancer organizations, including the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation as well. And we are delighted with your response to our program today. We have over 475 participants on the program today, and you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of the United States. And we have international participants from Australia, Canada, Germany, Ireland, Spain, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. Today's program was supported by an educational grant from Veristem, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing. There also is information about all of our collaborating organizations as a resource to all of you. Those are free resources for all of you in addition to Cancer Care. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you at the end of today's program to please complete that evaluation form. You know, your feedback is really very important to us in planning future programs. You are the best people to tell us the topics of the workshops that we should do going forward, or your recommendations about programs. We are planning many programs at this point, and we very much rely upon what you have to say so that we're sure the programs are most relevant to meet your needs. So I look forward to your feedback and planning programs that will be most responsive to each of your needs. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Lee Krug. And Dr. Krug is Associate Attending Physician, Division of Thoracic Oncology, Department of Medicine, Director of the Mesothelioma Program, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Krug is going to present an overview of mesothelioma. He's going to talk about treatment choices and the role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Krug.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and welcome everyone to the call today. My name is Lee Krug. I'm a thoracic oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering. I treat patients with mesothelioma and lung cancer, and run several clinical trials for those patients. I'm also the chair of the board of directors for the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation. And the structure of my discussion today is going to start with an overview about mesothelioma. We'll talk about some of the epidemiology and the workup that patients usually go through when they're first diagnosed. We'll talk about some of the standard treatments that are available, and then at the end, we'll discuss some of the clinical trials that are currently ongoing. So first, by way of introduction, I'm going to speak primarily today about mesothelioma that starts in the pleura, or pleural mesothelioma. That's the lining that's around the lung, and that would be the place where most mesothelioma cancers start. Mesothelioma can also occur less commonly in the peritoneum. The peritoneum is the lining around the abdomen. And even more rare can be mesothelioma cancers that start in the lining around the testis or in the lining around the heart. Mesothelioma is a pretty uncommon diagnosis. There are only about 2,000 to 3,000 cases per year diagnosed in the United States. That actually makes it 100-fold less common than lung cancer. It's also a disease that's predominantly seen more commonly in men, and that, of course, is because of the known occupational exposure related to asbestos. Asbestos exposure is the one thing we're aware of that does increase your risk for developing mesothelioma. Patients who have been exposed to asbestos can have a latency period, a time between the exposure to asbestos and the time that they get the cancer, of 20 years or more. That being said, I certainly see a lot of patients who don't have any clear-cut causes or exposure to asbestos that would explain that diagnosis. There can be other less common reasons why some patients develop mesothelioma. For example, if a patient with Hodgkin lymphoma had prior radiation treatment. And there are even some rare familial cases where multiple generations have developed mesothelioma. And there have been some mutations, in particular one in a gene called BAP1, that can predispose patients in those situations to developing mesothelioma, and other cancers as well. But that probably occurs in about 1% or less of cases. So when I see a patient with mesothelioma, it's striking to me that many of them actually present with the same types of symptoms. So patients will typically develop shortness of breath as their initial symptom. This shortness of breath will develop over the course of several weeks or months, and then they will be found to have some fluid accumulation in the lung. When this occurs, patients will have the fluid drained and sent off to the lab, and usually that fluid does not show any cancer cells in it. It's only after a patient has a biopsy that the diagnosis will be made. Most of the time at the initial diagnosis, patients will not have any signs of spread of the cancer to other places. It will really be just confined to the area around the lung. But later on in the disease, it may spread to the abdomen or even to the liver and bone. There are different types of mesothelioma, and it's important to know what type of mesothelioma one has. It gives you a sense of how aggressive or not the disease is going to behave. So the most common one is something called epithelioid type. That is one that generally responds better to chemotherapy and generally has a better prognosis. The prognosis can be quite variable. Some patients can have more fast-growing disease and others may have more slow-growing disease. And in fact, I've seen some cases where patients can live for many years. The other end of the spectrum is the sarcomatoid type. Fortunately, that's the less common type, but that is one that does behave a little more aggressively and responds less commonly to chemotherapy. And then there's a biphasic type or mixed, where there are components of both the epithelioid and the sarcomatoid types, and those have an intermediate prognosis. Nowadays, you probably hear a lot about different types of mutations that we find in cancers and the use of targeted therapies to try to use that molecular information to identify treatments that would be honed into those changes in the cancer cells. And there are certain mutations that are really common in mesothelioma. I mentioned the BAP1 gene. Although that occurs in families only about 1% of the time, it can be found in the cancer cells about 20% of the time. There are also genes called NF2 and CDKN2A that are very common. But unfortunately, at least to date, we haven't found any targeted therapies that work against those particular mutations. Although we're doing our best to try to find those, and in fact, I'll mention one of those later on in the talk. After a patient is a diagnosis of mesothelioma, it's important to determine how extensive the disease is and to make sure it hasn't spread to other places. And this helps us determine the stage of the cancer. That stage means how advanced is the disease. One of the important factors is whether the mesothelioma has spread beyond the chest into the chest wall, where the ribs and muscles of the chest are, because that has significant implications with regards to whether or not a patient can go through surgery. As I mentioned, less commonly, patients have spread of the cancer. And the determination of the stage, along with the type of cancer, the type of mesothelioma you have, that is the epithelioid, sarcomatoid, or mixed type, really helps guide the physician to know what are the best treatment options and also what's the general prognosis. So when I first meet a patient, the determination at first is whether or not the patient would benefit from any surgery. And this really depends on those factors, the type of mesothelioma it is and the stage, and also on the fitness of the patient. If you have a patient who has relatively early stage disease with no signs of spread and is very fit, sometimes patients can be treated with surgery. There are two kinds of surgery. The most common one that's used now is one just where patient has removal of the lining of the lung. That's called a pleurectomy. The more extreme surgery is called a extrapleural pneumonectomy, where a patient has the lining of the lung removed along with the entire lung and the diaphragm on that side. That approach has not really proven to be more beneficial with regards to outcomes than just the pleurectomy alone, and as such, most people are shifting their paradigm to give for more patients to just have the pleurectomy surgery. Unfortunately, surgery alone is not really adequate to completely treat the cancer, and there are many groups that are developing techniques to try to give another treatment in addition to the surgery to help with the with any cancer cells that may be remaining after the operation. Many of those are directed at the surgery site specifically. So, for example, the group at University of Pennsylvania is looking at something called photodynamic therapy, where they shine light on the lining of the lung and make that light-sensitive cancer to help treat that. Here at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and in conjunction with MD Anderson, we're exploring the use of radiation to treat the entire edge of the lung. And then there are other groups looking at other factors such as intrapleural chemotherapy. We also have a vaccine trial that we're conducting here at our hospital, where we try to boost up the patient's immune response against a particular antigen called WT1 that we see on the surface of mesothelioma tumors, and we're giving that to patients after they've completed the surgery, chemotherapy, and or radiation. For patients with more advanced disease or for patients who really are unable to go through such an aggressive treatment course, we treat those patients with chemotherapy. Currently, there's really only one standard chemotherapy regimen that patients receive. That's with a drug called pemetrexed, or the trade name for it is Alimta. And it's given in combination with another drug, usually cisplatin or carboplatin. And those drugs can be quite effective for patients with mesothelioma and have definitely shown to improve survival and to improve quality of life. The challenge is what to do for patients in addition to treatment with that chemotherapy regimen. Typically, after patients finish a course of chemotherapy, usually anywhere between 4 and 6 treatments, then usually patients are just monitored for a period of time, and then if the cancer starts to grow again, then they would be re-challenged with chemotherapy. One of the clinical trials that is currently ongoing is to give patients a treatment after their first-line chemotherapy, to see if the response that they get with the chemotherapy can be maintained for longer. This is with a drug that is called a FAK inhibitor, that's F-A-K, and this drug is a pill and has been shown in the laboratory to be most effective for mesothelioma tumors that have the mutation, the NF2 mutation that I was mentioning before. And so this has the potential to actually be one of the first targeted therapies in this particular disease. So in this particular trial, patients who have had chemotherapy and who have done well with that, meaning that they have had no evidence of growth or maybe even they've shown some tumor response, then those patients are enrolled on the study and then are randomized to get the FAK inhibitor or a placebo. And then they're monitored for a period of time, and hopefully we aim to see that the patients who receive the FAK inhibitor are able to maintain their response for longer. The other challenging group of patients are those who have received those chemotherapy drugs, but then their treatment has lost its effect, and the cancer has started to grow despite the treatment with that chemotherapy treatment. And there are several trials going on right now for those particular patients. One of the larger trials going on is one with an immunotherapy drug called tremelimumab. There's been a lot of press about these drugs as well that boost up the immune reaction and allows the immune system to then fight against the cancer. There was a smaller trial that was done in Italy where patients with mesothelioma were treated with this drug, tremelimumab, and they did see some activity, and that has led to this large randomized trial. And in this particular trial, patients who have had chemotherapy and have growth of their cancer following that treatment are then randomized to get the tremelimumab, or two-thirds of them get the tremelimumab or one-third get placebo. I don't have time to discuss all the ongoing clinical trials that are going on right now. Those are two of the larger studies that are enrolling patients quite all around the world, actually. And there are many others. Some of them are not, and those two happen to be randomized trials, but there are many that are not, and many that are developing other targeted therapies and so forth. I think that the decision about going on a clinical trial is a challenging one, and it's important to find one that's most appropriate for a patient and to make sure that patients are eligible for these studies. And with regards to that, I think it's important that one speaks to their oncologist to try to get information about that. It's very hard sometimes to sort through all the information on the internet. The other options are to contact various groups. In particular, the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation is a great resource. Mary Hestorfer, who is the director there, has a lot of clinical insight. Having been a nurse practitioner for 16 years treating patients with this disease, she's also a great resource in that regard. I unfortunately don't have time now to go over all the various specifics about this treatment, but I hope that my discussion has given you some overview and some ideas about the current treatments. And frankly, this is actually an exciting time for this disease. I think there are more clinical trials going on now than there ever have been before, and some with very promising results that will hopefully lead us to develop some better treatments in the near future. So now I'm going to hand the call back over to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Crew. That was really outstanding, and I think there may be questions for you during the Q&A, so we'll give you more chance to elaborate on some of the trials. So thank you so much, and appreciate your speaking on the call. And our next presenter is Dr. Richard Grala. Dr. Grala is professor of medicine, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And Dr. Grala is going to address communicating with your healthcare team, key questions to ask your doctor, physical quality of life and lifestyle concerns, and physical activity and nutritional and hydrational issues and tips. And I'm going to turn this program over to Dr. Grala.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. It's a real pleasure to be on this call today with Dr. Krug and Mary Hestorfer and Wynn and Carolyn. I'd like to add my welcome to everybody who's with us today. Like Dr. Krug, I'm a medical oncologist, and I specialize in thoracic oncology, which includes lung cancer and mesothelioma. We, too, are involved in many research trials, but of course, for all of us who are on this call, it's the treatment of every aspect that a patient and family has that is so very important. Now, I think Dr. Krug really brought up and brought to focus, why should we talk about communication? Why is communication so important? Dr. Krug has already told us of the various individual aspects of the cancer, of the treatment, and it's really can be difficult to sort through this, and so one needs a healthcare team, and that's what we're all about. And so if we're going to individualize care, Dr. Krug talked about different stages, different presentations of mesothelioma, even some genetic differences. So we are really in the era of individualizing care so that your care can have as positive an effect as possible on preserving and improving quality of life. There have been some remarkable improvements in the prevention or treatment of symptoms and side effects associated with mesothelioma and its treatment. and this has occurred over the last several years. And we're really in an evolutionary period of how to maximize the benefit of these newer methods. Sometimes we call this supportive care, and it is at least as individualized and complicated as the anti-cancer care. Each patient, each person, each family has different issues that come up, have different symptoms or side effects, and some people only get a very few, and others have different ones. So only by talking about these problems can the best remedy be applied. In fact, there's a new term that's now used that's called patient-reported outcomes, or PROs. This reflects that in many areas, only through patient and family input can we really understand what an individual's issue is. Of course, in many instances, your doctor or nurse may raise the issue, but there's no need to stand on ceremony. It's fine to bring up what's on your mind, and it's appreciated. Sometimes, very often, in fact, people have concepts on their mind that really are not very likely and are not things very likely to bother one, but only if we talk about it can we make sure that we all understand what's going on. Physicians, nurses, social workers, and pharmacists, among others in oncology, spend a great deal of time educating themselves about the best approaches to these problems. And their oncology organizations, such as ASCO, Oncology Nursing Society, Multinational Association for Supportive Care in Cancer, which is MASC, the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation, Cancer Care, and others, all help both patients and healthcare professionals to be on the same wavelength. So we're really your team. There are some specialists called experts in palliative medicine. The new approach is for patients to receive the best of both, the best of appropriate anti-cancer treatment plus the best of appropriate palliative or supportive treatment, not just one or the others. We know that symptoms are common in people with mesothelioma. Well over 90% of people have two or more symptoms. So it's really necessary to approach all these together so that people can live better and live longer. And surveys show that patients and families are equally interested in learning more about anti-cancer treatments and equally interested in learning about ways to prevent and treat symptoms or side effects. 95% of patients say that these aspects are either important or very important to them. Let me give you a few examples. Again, Dr. Krug just outlined several different treatments, and these include surgery, and there are post-operative issues such as pain or shortness of breath, fever at times, or maybe none of these, but we need to communicate for this to go as well as possible. He mentioned many research approaches, which always involve close follow-up, especially with newer treatments. And he also mentioned that one of the most used treatments, as an example, is chemotherapy, especially with pemetrexed and cisplatin. Communication is central because we know that with platinum drugs, such as he mentioned, nausea and vomiting, as an example, can occur. Here, the prevention of nausea and vomiting problems is most important. But we have to understand that there's the nausea and vomiting of the first day of treatment, and then that which could begin even a few days later. So sometimes we prescribe medicines to prevent nausea and vomiting that should be taken for several days and even after the chemotherapy, and even if one is doing very well. So it's crucial that we all understand this and that we communicate well. There's even an app that's a free download from the Multinational Association for Supportive Care in Cancer for an iPhone or Android, which can help with the communication of nurses and patients and doctors on this. Now, pain occurs not infrequently associated with mesothelioma and sometimes post-op, and every patient receives different medications, different doses. These need to be personalized. If it's going well, that's terrific. But if there are any issues or side effects like sleepiness or constipation, it's really so important to communicate about these factors so that the treatment can be optimized. These are just some of the important aspects which affect all aspects of quality of life. So we need to communication is part of everyday medical and nursing practice. While I mentioned an app, technology can assist, but nothing will ever replace person-to-person, face-to-face communication. Communication includes also the acquiring of knowledge, as cancer care does with programs like this, with its webpage, major governmental helplines like 1-800-FOR-CANCER, ASCO, ACS has these, and you'll also find, as Mary will tell us more, I'm sure, about the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation, which has some terrific information on its websites. But there are different styles that we all have for communicating, whether it's online, which is available to us at any different time, by email, sometimes with one's nurse or doctor, or by telephone. But real personalization requires collaboration with your oncology healthcare team, especially, again, addressing different styles. Now, Carolyn also asked me to address issues relating to nutrition, weight loss, appetite loss. And to make matters more difficult, these problems can not only be related to the cancer itself, but also can be linked with anti-cancer treatments. Studies show that a seemingly simple but important issue is that of becoming dehydrated. And even being a little behind on fluids can worsen many of the other common problems, such as nausea or weakness or constipation. We'd even mentioned that constipation is associated with pain medicine, so being dehydrated makes that worse, so it just sort of adds on top of each other. It's good to measure formally the amount of liquid one has, or, you know, if you have a quart bottle of a favorite fluid, that maybe that should be only for the patient, and you know that that quart is gone when you've taken it. So none of us are very accurate at measuring how much fluid or remembering how much fluid we've taken in, so being really closely aware of that can be helpful. And, you know, almost any fluid is okay. I advise people to vary the fluids they take in to avoid boredom of drinking a favorite fluid again and again and again. So it's good to aim for at least 2 quarts a day as a general rule. But again, it'll be helpful depending on how large you are, what other issues and other medicines you're taking as to how to individualize this, again, emphasizing communication. We recently asked over 3,000 patients and their support persons about what issues are important to them. Nearly 90% of these individuals identified nutrition, appetite, and weight loss as being among the top concerns. 91% reported that dealing with fatigue was highly important. All these issues interfere with pursuing normal activities. And, of course, over 95% of patients told us that normal functioning is crucial for them, and that's no surprise, I think, to anybody on this call. So the need for improvement is abundantly clear, and the need for communicating about this is very clear as well. So what approaches are available for issues such as appetite and weight loss? Clearly, the most effective and best approach is to try to treat the mesothelioma successfully itself, thus stopping the related stimulus for muscle and weight loss. But this isn't always possible, and even if the cancer is controlled, appetite and weight loss issues can continue. Paying attention to a good balanced diet and proper hydration, proper fluids, is always a great idea. While this can be helpful, unfortunately, it's often not sufficient to reverse these persistent problems. We need to individualize these nutritional steps and strategies, which might include frequent smaller meals or to take advantage of the time of day when greater appetite is present. Sometimes that's the morning, as many have found. And to learn about the benefits of appropriate exercise, not overdoing, not spending one's energy on various machines, but good, normal exercise and being social and being around can help with fatigue and with many, many other issues. Most cancer centers have experts in these areas who are more than willing to help with planning and monitoring better nutrition and activities based on individual needs and preferences, again, emphasizing communication. There are some medicines that are currently available for appetite and weight, such as the a progesteronic hormone called Megase, but in truth, it's really not very effective. It has more effect on appetite than it does on weight, and none of these issues, including the issue of medical marijuana or THC, help build back muscle, and that's really the most important area these days. And that's called lean body mass, building up muscle. And there are several very interesting research initiatives underway for that, which look much more promising in building muscle strength. And these include signals to cells to build muscle and even stimulate appetite, and even some other hormonal ways that that are free from largely free from side effects that we often associate with hormones. Fortunately, these major research initiatives are underway right now, and just as research into newer treatments are available, you can ask your doctor or nurse whether there are those aspects going on, and clinicaltrials.gov is helpful, and of course the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation is very helpful on all of this as well. So it's been my pleasure to be with you on this call, and I'll conclude once again by saying that communicating with your team can really help to make sure that your needs are addressed, not to be bashful about it, that cancer care and its treatment's complicated. That's why having a real team in place is so important. Thanks again, and I'll turn the call back over to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Grala. That was really wonderful and very informative. And thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A period as well. And our next speaker is Mary Herstorfer, and Ms. Herstorfer is a nurse practitioner. She's executive director of Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation, and she'll be addressing decision making during the continuum of your disease and the free support programs and services offered by the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Herstorfer.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and it's a pleasure to be part of this panel. I'm honored to be among such really wonderful clinicians who are working in this field and really helping our patient population. So I guess to begin with, I just wanted to introduce you a little bit to the Mesothelioma Foundation. We are the national charity for mesothelioma, and our main focus in terms of work that we do is that we have a superior peer-reviewed grants grants program where we've funded over $8.7 million to research projects that come in from around the world. So we're really having a big impact on advancing the science behind the disease because, as Dr. Krug has mentioned, there's only one approved treatment for mesothelioma, so we really need to focus on research and focus on getting, you know, more drugs into the hands of our patients. We also advocate for the government, the Department of Defense particularly, to fund more mesothelioma research. And because of our advocacy efforts, $8.9 million of research funding has started coming through the Department of Defense. We really feel that the Department of Defense has a moral obligation to fund this disease, as so many of our patients are, 30% actually, are veterans of foreign wars. Again, you know, I think that it's the most important focus is clinical trials, and as Dr. Krug spoke a little bit about them, you know, we talk about some of our frontline therapies, we talk about second, third line, and we know that it's important for patients to know about, you know, what's out there. So one of the roles of the Mesothelioma Foundation is to make sure that patients are made aware of all of their options. So in other words, the standard of care would be pemetrexed, also known as Alimta, and cisplatinum. Now, we have clinical trials today. We have a trial of a drug called CRS-207, which is a vaccine trial, which can be given prior to the administration of Alimta and cisplatinum, and that's a targeted agent. We also have another trial called the COMMAND trial, where an oral agent, the FAK inhibitor that Dr. Krug spoke about, is offered at the conclusion of chemotherapy for those patients who are stable or responding to treatment. So there are many options, and, you know, when we work with patients, you know, it's really, you know, it's our, you know, privilege to be able to sit down with a patient and be able to take a full medical history, take insurance history, find out, you know, where do you live? Are you comfortable traveling? Do you have any other needs that would make traveling difficult? What type of insurance that you have? Are you a risk taker? Are you the type of person who would like to explore something new and innovative, or are you somebody who would like to stay with something, you know, more tried and true? And we take you through the whole process of exploring what the options are, exploring your level of comfort, and to help you, you know, really reflect back upon how you make decisions, because all of us make decisions based upon our prior experience. So you may have had someone in your family who had a terrible experience at a major medical center, and that would certainly color, you know, color your opinion on whether or not you would want to enter into a clinical trial. But if someone in your family was very successfully treated at a university setting, you would be more apt then to enroll in a trial. So, you know, we look at things in sort of a microcosm, like, you know, like sort of a minute focus on what has affected us or our family. And when you're entering into the world of mesothelioma, which is such a complex disease, you need to have more of a global focus. You need to understand that something may not have worked for one patient, but, you know, it may work for 10 other patients, but you may not be aware of those patients. And also connecting with a physician is a very personal type of, you know, a very personal choice. You know, when you meet your doctor, there sometimes is an immediate relationship that develops, and sometimes there's not. And it's okay then to, you know, call and we'll work with you on terms in terms of finding a specialist in the area or getting a second opinion. We also feel very strongly that patients should have access to clinical trials, and though you may be covered by insurance or you may have Medicare, which, you know, certainly covers clinical trials around the country, you may not have the means to get to those clinical trials. So the foundation actually has a travel grants program where not only will we send you to see a specialist to get a second opinion, but if you enroll in a clinical trial, we will do our best to ensure that you can get back and forth for that clinical trial, because we do think it's so important. And we know that any disease that's made progress, it's made progress because people have been successfully enrolled in clinical trials. And each step of a clinical trial teaches us something. And I think we have to change the mindset. You know, you still hear, you know, kind of whispers about, you know, well, I don't want to be a guinea pig. Whereas I think the focus today really should be not, you know, that it's, you're not a guinea pig. What it is you're really being offered a unique opportunity to try something new and innovative that clearly can make, you know, a difference in your disease, especially when you look at some of the new treatments that we're studying that, you know, is offering the standard of care, and then giving something either before or after that might, you know, might make it work better. And that's really what this is all about. It's trying to, you know, increase survival, increase time to relapse, find new ways to prevent some of the side effects that Dr. Gralla spoke about. You know, clinical trials, you can find them for pain, for breathing issues, for treatment, for surgery. There are just so many different trials and so many areas of expertise, and we certainly would like to help you, you know, explore all those options. We have online support groups, which are by invitation only. They're moderated, and they're meant for patients, for caregivers, and for people who've lost ones to the disease. We feel that, you know, by invitation and by screening, we know that then we're protecting the privacy of those people on the call. So we know who's on the call, and we've put together the right group of people to be able to converse and help each other from both a peer, you know, from a peer level, as well as having professionals on the line. We have telephone support group for the phone. We have online support group, which is for all the categories as well. And we've recently launched a program called MesoConnect. And MesoConnect is where we put people who are affected by mesothelioma. And, of course, that covers the children, and, you know, it's usually adult children, caregivers, spouses, people who've lost loved ones. And we hook them up with a buddy, someone who has this shared experience who can help them with, you know, each step of the journey. Mesothelioma is a rare disease, 3,000 cases or so a year. And, you know, oftentimes you might live in a state where there may be only 5 cases diagnosed. So it would be very rare for you to meet another patient who's, you know, understands the significance of the diagnosis. So I think, you know, these are, you know, just some of the programs that we have. And I, you know, as I said, I think it's important for you to know about them. We send out information packages about the disease, a book that will teach you a lot about mesothelioma, outlining some of the questions that you should be asking your healthcare team. So this way, when you go into the exam room, you're familiar with some of the language, because it is a new language to learn. You're a little familiar with the disease, and you're sort of guided with some of the questions that are going to help you to make some of these important decisions. Because, again, making any kind of a decision, You need to understand the lay of the land. You need to understand the language of the disease. And you need to understand just a little bit more about, you know, what we call the nuances. How does this disease affect your life? And, you know, how do you live with mesothelioma? And, you know, I truly believe that people have to live with hope, that if you take away hope, then there is no life. So I think it's very important that we try to focus on the positive. We look for, you know, innovation. We look for ways to support. We look for ways to find joy in living, because there should be a lot of joy in this. Despite the cancer diagnosis, there's, you know, life is still, you know, for grabbing. So I'm available to answer questions at any time. It's mary@curemeso.org, which is curemeso.org, which is also our website. And, you know, I don't want to take too much time, because I know Dr. Messner has, you know, other panel members to introduce you to, but just to let you know that we are here for the patients. Dr. Messner, I'll turn the line back over to you, and thank you for the opportunity to present our work as well.
Well, thank you very much, Mary. It was wonderful, excellent presentation. And our next speaker is Wynn Burkle, and Mr. Burkle is an oncology social worker, director of social service, Long Island, lung cancer program coordinator, cancer care. And Mr. Burkle is going to review with you the free psychosocial services that you can access from cancer care. Mr. Burkle.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. You know, I'm sure most of us remember the time we moved into our first new home, or even our last new home, and I'm sure most of us wondered how we were ever going to find our way in this new community or neighborhood. Many of us were fortunate enough to get a visit from the welcome wagon, or maybe a very helpful neighbor who helped us find the nearest supermarket, service station, house of worship, school, and all the other services so essential to support our daily life. The more things we were able to connect to in our new neighborhood, the more we felt that we had things under control. You know, being diagnosed with mesothelioma is in some ways very much like moving into a new neighborhood. Our cancer pushes us into a strange and sometimes scary new environment, and we really don't know where anything is and what we can do to get some control over a very difficult change in our lives. Fortunately, cancer care serves the role of that good neighbor who is there to help you find your way in this strange new place. Let's take a look at how. Cancer care is usually friendly website, www.cancercare.org, in addition to providing a wealth of cancer information and topics, serves as a convenient entry point to connect with the many services which Cancer Care makes available free of charge for cancer patients and those who care for them. These services include things such as education and a wide range of supportive assistance. Let's look at these services in a bit more detail. Cancer Care's educational program reaches out to include its array of Connect Education workshops, which provide information on coping with the physical and emotional impact of cancer, such as today's workshop, as well as informative workshops on diagnosis-specific cancer topics. Replays of these workshops are available both online at Cancer Care's website, www.cancercare.org, and via your phone. Many folks find it convenient to download these replays to their iPods and MP3 players. The education program also provides Cancer Care's well-known Cancer Care Connect booklets, which are available free of charge and are packed up with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help cancer patients and those who care for them. To date, we have distributed over 3 million of these very popular publications. You know, while one is at our website, they can also sign up for Cancer Care's popular free e-newsletter or catch up with our latest informative CopeLink blogs. Cancer Care support services are provided by its professionally trained staff of experienced oncology social workers who are there to assist folks like you in dealing with the many issues which arise from the diagnosis of cancer. These issues may include assistance with emotional issues, in which they assist clients and provide appropriate, helpful psychosocial interventions. Assistance with practical issues, such as financial assistance through Cancer Care's limited financial assistance program, and referrals to the Cancer Care Copay Foundation and other financial assistance resources. Assistance in finding resources. Our social workers refer folks to the many organizations and agencies out there which have been established to help cancer patients. Assistance in navigating the system, in which Cancer Care social workers assist people in understanding how to best manage the many new relationships involved in the healthcare environment, and assistance in communications, in which our workers are skilled at helping folks learn how to best communicate with their healthcare providers, employers, friends, and family members about their new situation. Cancer care social workers provide this assistance in a variety of friendly settings, such as at Cancer Care's national office and its regional offices in the tri-state New York metropolitan area, where folks can receive individual and group counseling face-to-face, over the phone, where people from across the nation can find immediate assistance by contacting the Cancer Care Helpline at 1-800-813-HOPE-HOPE, and longer-term assistance through individual telephone counseling with a cancer care social worker. You know, I'm sure none of us ever expected to find ourselves moved to the neighborhood of mesothelioma. But now that you're here, be assured that Cancer Care, like that good neighbor, is there with you. Connect with us at www.cancercare.org or by calling us at 1-800-813-HOPE, H-O-P-E. Thank you. I'll turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Wynn. That was wonderful. And thank you. All of our speakers have been terrific. And now we do have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Danielle to explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. Danielle, could you explain to everybody how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Once again, if you do have a question, please press star, then 1.
And we have a question for one of our online participants. So the question is, what is new in your approach to treating peritoneal mesothelioma? Dr. Krug, can you address that?
Yes, I'm happy to discuss it. I will admit that I'm a thoracic oncologist, so I treat primarily the pleural mesothelioma. Certainly, I have had many patients with peritoneal mesothelioma that I've seen over the years as well. Those patients are more often treated with surgical resection. And oftentimes those patients are treated as well with chemotherapy, and in particular many of them will get intraperitoneal chemotherapy. There's different approaches to that. Sometimes it's given in the operating room, sometimes it's given after surgery. Some of the trials that I had discussed are available for patients with peritoneal mesothelioma. They are included as being eligible for some of the clinical trials, although not all of them. And so that would involve just discussing with your treating physician or with others that are conducting those trials about whether or not one would be eligible for those studies.
Thank you. And there's another question in front of our participants to distinguish what is the difference between lung cancer and mesothelioma. Then, Dr. Krug, could you address that?
Sure. Thank you for that question. These cancers actually start in different parts of the body, even though they are both starting in the chest. So a lung cancer is one that starts in the tissues of the lung that can grow there, whereas mesothelioma that starts in the chest starts in the pleura, which is a very thin, paper-thin lining that encases the lung. And so what we see for patients with mesothelioma is that the cancer actually goes around the lung as almost like an envelope or a coating around the lung, and it's not necessarily a disease that starts in the lung. So there's a very important distinction there. A lot of times patients with mesothelioma are misclassified as having lung cancer, but they are quite different, and the treatment for them does vary.
Thank you. And there's also a question of who is at increased risk for developing mesothelioma? Dr. Krug, if you could address that.
Sure. So patients who have had exposure to asbestos, usually that occurs in one's occupation. Those are people that are pipe fitters, construction workers, electricians, plumbers. Many in the military may have increased exposure to asbestos, such as those in the Navy that are on ships, which often use a lot of asbestos. And there are other occupations that have that exposure. Those patients are at increased risk. Now, it's important to understand that just because one is exposed to asbestos, that their risk of getting mesothelioma is still quite low. And only a small fraction of patients that are exposed to asbestos are eventually develop that during their lifetime. And it's really for that reason that it's very challenging to actually screen patients for mesothelioma, meaning try to detect it early. There are some programs going on, at least in the New York City area. So for patients that live in this area, for example, Mount Sinai has some programs where they will monitor people who have been exposed to asbestos. They have another program for the first responders to 9/11, for example. But that obviously may not be available to many of the people on the call. But as of now, there are no good screening tools. Getting CAT scans at periodic intervals, for example, has not yet really been shown to be beneficial, and that's because the risk of developing mesothelioma is so low, even if you have had asbestos exposure.
Thank you. And it's a question for actually Mary Hustoffer, in terms of the question was how you became involved with your organization.
Okay, so I actually started at Columbia Presbyterian, and I was a research nurse. And I started to work with a Dr. Robert Taub, and together we developed the Mesothelioma Center. So for many years, I worked as a clinical research nurse, helping to write clinical trials and, you know, treating patients there. And then I left Columbia Presbyterian, and the foundation created a role for me. I do continue to see patients, but, you know, I really had, you know, my early grounding, and I had a very good mentor and teacher in Dr. Taub. So I really, you know, at that point, I really had a good chance to learn about the disease and to see a wide variety of patients.
So did you want to say something a little bit more about your work at the Clinical Trials Center?
Yeah. So I actually participate in a clinic at the National Cancer Institute, so I, you know, still actively are engaged in seeing mesothelioma patients. But I'd say that, you know, the majority of my focus right now is working one-on-one with patients and family members, again, you know, discussing clinical trials, disease and symptom management, and oftentimes translating what's said in the exam room. You know, so many times, you know, you're there, you think you hear it all, you come home, and all of a sudden you realize, gee, what did that mean? So I'm usually able to help a patient sort of sort out, you know, what the language was, what they meant by it. You know, this is not necessarily a bad thing. This is really what they were saying to you, or perhaps helping them to reformulate questions to take back in. What I forgot to mention, which I think is very important that we do, is every year we have a yearly symposium, and we bring together patients, researchers, and physicians interested in mesothelioma. And people really come from globally to this conference, and we have separate scientific meetings where the scientists meet, but then the scientists leave those meetings and they present directly to the, you know, the family members and those affected by mesothelioma. And they talk about the latest in treatment options. We grapple with a lot of the questions that still need to be addressed in mesothelioma. And it really, I think it empowers a patient to be able to, at lunchtime, you know, sit with a pathologist from Australia or to meet a surgeon from New York City when they live in Oklahoma. And it really makes it sort of, you know, like a small stage where we can all interact on so many different levels.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And we have a question from one of our participants online from Marcia. If one has had surgery and chemo and scans are now clean, does it matter that the type of mesothelioma was dysphagic? Is there anything additional that should be done given that? Dr. Krug?
So I think, obviously, that's great news for you. for the most part, after patients receive surgery, if they've had some other treatment generally recommended, such as chemotherapy, then they would be monitored. As I mentioned, we do have our vaccine trial that is going on here in New York at Memorial Sloan Kettering with the WT1 vaccine. But otherwise, the usual care at this point would just be to monitor patients periodically. I mean, I will say that patients are at risk for having the cancer grow back at some point, but I have seen cases where it has not, and I think the patients just need to be monitored frequently with CT scans.
We have another question from one of our participants regarding a brother who was diagnosed with asbestosis and is seeking a possible lung transplant. And I guess the question is how that would be treated in terms of, so Dr. Krug, if you could address that.
Well, asbestosis is, it's a chronic lung condition that is related to asbestos exposure and causes some scarring in the lungs. And that's actually different than mesothelioma, and that's actually beyond the scope of the mesothelioma discussion that we're having today. So I would probably defer that talk, that response to, to the treating physicians who are probably pulmonologists who would be the ones that would treat that condition.
Excellent. Thank you. So we recommend that you actually would go back to your treating healthcare team and discuss that with them. Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call, wonderful speakers today on the call, and actually wonderful people asking questions as well. So I want to thank you all for that as well, who really have helped to enhance the call with your questions. I do want to remind all of you, and all of you have been listening as well, thank you, and I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so I'd like to, remind all of you of the services that you can access from Cancer Care and from the Mesothelioma Applied Research Foundation as well. We're all here to help you, and you've heard both from Mary and Wynn about the various services that the organizations provide, and we all have 800 numbers and websites, and we encourage you to call us for any help that we can provide you. Cancer Care, of course, provides a lot of supportive counseling services, and Mesothelioma Research Foundation also provides a lot of help in terms of decision-making about your treatment and care. So please utilize the organizations, their free services, and most importantly, as we conclude today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with mesothelioma or with cancer. I want you to know that you're part of this community here, and we're here to help you. And we're simply a phone call or a website away and from all of you. So thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.